Today I'll be interviewing the editor of a book that just came out through AK Press, which is called Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth. And it's a book that's kind of, it's an ambitious book taking on revolutionary environmentalism. That's kind of the phrase used a lot in this book. And it's a collection of writings from all kinds of different people, like dozens of people from, you know, political prisoners and guerrilla warriors and Black Panthers and indigenous warriors and you know, anti-civilization strategists and theorists and animal rights activists and environmental activists and eco-feminists and, I mean, all kinds of people. It's a really, really good book called Igniting a Revolution. You can get that from akpress.com. But the editor of the book is someone who's been on the show today. His name is Stephen Best. And, you know, he's a professor from the University of Texas in El Paso. And he teaches all kinds of stuff, like humanities, philosophy, you know, the philosophy of science and technology, animal rights, environmental theory, all kinds of stuff. And he's also the founder of the Center for Animal Liberation Affairs, and he talks a lot about kind of radical animal liberation stuff. And he's also the co-author or the co-editor of a book called Terrorists or Freedom Fighters, Reflections on the Liberation of Animals. And he regularly gives talks around the country and around the world, even on all kinds of topics like state repression, direct action, animal rights, all kinds of stuff. All right, Steve?
Yeah.
Hey. So welcome to the show. I've introduced you at a bit of length so far, and I've talked a little bit about Igniting a Revolution, so maybe we can just jump right into it. You know, I'm so thankful you put together that book, and I think it's a really ambitious book, too, that has come together pretty excellently. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about this book, like what were the main things you wanted to contribute by putting this book together, and what do you think are some of the most important things within it to offer now?
Sure. It's the second effort I did with Tony Nocella, and pretty much set on the same model as our first book, Terrorists or Freedom Fighters, which is the first real study, I think, of the Animal Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Tactics. And what we tried to do in both books is to look at a variety of voices and perspectives on radical ideas and put people together that ordinarily don't come together and actually try to build some bridges amongst different communities. So, for instance, in both books, you'll find essays by political prisoners, radical academics, ecofeminists, Black liberationists, Native Americans, and so on. So the books are meant not just to study history, but to actually help make it and to contribute to what we think is an important element of radical politics today, and that is the project of bridge building, forming alliances, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
So that same model we pretty much followed in the new book, Igniting a Revolution, Voices in Defense of the Earth. But that latter book is what proved to be even a bigger project. We have, I think, instead of 20 contributors, over 40 contributors. And we pretty much rounded up everybody that we could think of. And we also have poets in the book who begin every section with a political poem, which is a nice way to start off. And the sections are divided into different types of analyses and issues, like critiques of direct action, or analyses of direct action, relationships between environmentalism and race issues, the history of radical environmentalism. And on that point, I think there's some really good things in the essay about the history of Earth First and the Earth Liberation Front and direct action tactics for the environment as they evolved in England and the United States and spread throughout the world. So it's really quite a big book. I think it reads very well. All the essays are very clear. It gives some new insights, I think, into what radical environmentalism is. I should say really revolutionary environmentalism, because that's the term that we use. And we try to distinguish that from radical environmentalism. There's been a whole host of radical theories that have been called that. And I think it's a difference, a distinction with a difference to talk about this as revolutionary environmentalism, because we're trying to map out a new approach that looks at the defense of the Earth literally by any means necessary, and so that all options for defense of the Earth are on the table now, all tactics, because we live in an era of advanced ecocide. This is an era of global warming. This is the sixth greatest extinction crisis on the planet. India and China are awakening giants who are moving toward huge consumer empires, themselves becoming fast food nations and automobile nations. And the problems that we face on this earth now are just staggering. And as we say in the book, there's really no time left now for further studies and analyses and debates and dialogues. I don't think there's much time left for the long march to the institutions. The planet is in a grave crisis right now, and we need actions that are appropriate to the level of the emergency situation that we see to exist on this planet. So revolutionary environmentalism, therefore, will include any and all struggles to a fight against oppressors and exploiters of the Earth. And so therefore you'll find in some areas of the world, in South America and elsewhere, that people are engaged in armed struggle against the giant oil companies, against people trying to destroy their villages, their way of life, their natural environment.
Mm-hmm. You wrote in an article, like, considering all these crises we have, you know, why is there not a revolution in this country right now, and why are people cruising the malls rather than rioting in the streets? And are Americans like the good Germans who went about their business in the midst of the Nazi genocide? And what are your thoughts on that? Like, why do you think people are so? I mean, why do you think that radical things that are called radical, that are called necessary in other countries, are called radical here? You know, and why are people so? I mean, what, you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, it's just amazing the fact that in the U.S. there is hardly any opposition to the most criminal, corrupt, and fascist administration that we've ever had, arguably. It's just amazing that people are carrying on their lives as if everything is normal. And part of it is the long-standing problems of the depoliticization of the citizenry here, that people are controlled by the propaganda of mass media, where mass media is basically a tool of the state. They're shaped and distracted by the spectacles of the mass entertainment society, what I call culture dope, the kind of televised or digitized narcotics that serves the purpose of soma to keep them happy and distracted from the real issues of the day. But it's also the fact that in the post 9/11 climate, people are still very afraid of so-called terrorists, not understanding that the most dangerous terrorist is the one they're looking to protect them. Of course, I'm talking about George Bush. And some of the recent polls here in the United States have shown that people are largely not concerned with the fact that Bush has violated the Constitution, violated the law in terms of his responsibilities to Congress to let them know when he's doing things like illegal eavesdropping on the American public and to get permission for that kind of action. They're okay with that because they are quite willing to trade their liberties for what they think is security. And of course, we don't have either here. And as Benjamin Franklin said some time back, those who give up their liberty for security deserve neither. And that's what we have here in the United States right now. We don't have liberty or security. But I think, you know, people are really looking to Father Bush for the security, the kind of security he can't provide, because, of course, he's just aggravating the problem of terrorism, not reducing it. And another situation here is that I think people are afraid to get politically involved today. Issues like the Shack 7 trial show that even legal, constitutionally protected forms of dissent can earn you the charge of eco-terrorism, can earn you a swarm of FBI paparazzi who are documenting your activities as if holding a sign in protest is a crime. Seems to be these days in the U.S. So there are a lot of reasons for that, but from the Democratic Party to the populace at large to certainly the so-called left, there's no opposition to Bush and the war and the biological meltdown that we see on the planet today. It just amazes me.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about what's known as the Green Scare, like you mentioned the Shack 7, just to let listeners know what's going on with that? I've talked about it a bunch on my show, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on what this says about the priorities and also the fears of those in power.
Yeah, the Green Scare is something I started talking about many years ago, and the term is catching on, finally. It of course, is meant to suggest that the times that we are living in right now, in the first decade of the 21st century, are very much, unfortunately, like the 50 years ago in the U.S., the era of the 1950s, when Senator Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Activity Committees prevailed, and there was a massive persecution in the U.S. against any form of dissent, any kind of activism, or even liberal values were demonized as a communist, where if you were seen at a party where so-called communists were, your picture was taken, and you were called to the U.S. Court system to account for yourself and pressure to name names. And, of course, it was an absolutely chilling time in American history. People lost their jobs. People suicided out of despair. People were afraid to show any kind of a dissent whatsoever. And ultimately that caved in, and the 1960s appeared for just a little fresh breath of liberation there. But that was annihilated fairly quickly, too. But now we have not the Red Scare, where the fear is of communism, and we have to fear communists taking over our country from domestic cells, but animal rights and environmental activism. So it's called the Green Scare, because the real threat to society today, according to the corporate state complex, are animal rights and environmental activists. And it's worth noting that, in fact, in these groups, environmentalists and animal rights activists, are the most dynamic political forces in the country today, and in other countries, such as England, because the social movements seem to have gone far, far into retreat. The only kind of real activity we've seen along that front has been, in the U.S. at least, has been with the anti-immigration struggles. And we had millions of people in the streets for a week or two in L.A. and Chicago and other places. But that's kind of died down, and I'm not sure that will actually become a serious justice movement. But apart from that, the real action is coming from animal rights and environmentalists. So they are a threat to the corporate state complex, and the corporate state complex understands that. So they have targeted them, and the best way that they can do that is by calling them not communists, because that threat is historically obsolete, but terrorists, and eco-terrorists specifically. And therefore, once they've been labeled accordingly, the corporate state complex can create new laws and bring the whole legal apparatus of terrorism and eco-terrorism down upon these activists in a crushing way. So that's what we see today, the Green Scare, where we're supposed to believe that these people pose a threat to domestic security. This, of course, is ironic given the fact that we have militiamen, neo-fascists, Aryan nations, possibly super so-called super gangs coming over from the Mexican border that could have members of Al-Qaeda or very hostile anti-American forces coming over, all of which are far more dangerous than animal and earth liberation activists. But we're supposed to believe that these are the greatest threats to American security. Well, they're the greatest threats to corporations. And that's why they've been demonized, and that's why we have a Green Scare right now.
Mm-hmm. To put some things in a bit of local context, in Guelph here, where the city I'm in the past year there have been a handful of acts of sabotage claimed by the Earth Liberation Front and more that weren't claimed by them. And obviously you aren't involved in this kind of stuff yourself, but would you mind explaining some of the rationale behind this growing phenomenon of people who are working outside of the law to cause economic damage?
Yeah, there's a logic to radicalism, and that is that new and more militant approaches will always be developed according to their need, according to the realization that existing tactics, strategies, philosophies are limited and are inappropriate for the level of destruction and violence is being directed against this Earth and all of its species. So you can trace a dynamic, for instance, in both the animal and environmental movements, from welfarism to rights to liberation, from mainstream tactics to underground tactics, direct action, and forms of sabotage. So, for instance, the welfare approach in the animal rights or in the animal advocacy history and movement proved to be totally inadequate, because you could basically do anything to an animal and still say that somehow you were protecting its welfare. And it realized, certainly by the 1970s, that welfarism was in completely inadequate form of protection for the interests of animals, and that they need rights, that they have rights. These rights need to be protected. So an animal rights movement emerged that was something, a form of radical, at least philosophically. But politically, the animal rights movement used the same tactics as the animal welfare movement. These tactics were based on education and legislation. It was thought that by educating people and by passing new laws to try to promote animal rights, we could win this struggle for justice for animals. But it soon became apparent that the state is a completely corrupt entity, that corporate interests, not justice, dominate Congress and political structures in general, and that other forms, other tactics are needed to truly protect the interests of animals. And so if we can't rely on the state to defend the interests of animals, and we have to take that upon themselves. If the state is in bed with corporations, then we have to attack the corporations. And so economic sabotage was used as a way to undermine their ability to exploit animals in one of the most effective ways possible, and that is by attacking their profit motive, attacking their bottom line. And in many cases, this has worked, because a lot of animal exploiters are vulnerable to these kind of attacks, and they have been put out of business. You can see the same kind of dynamic in the environmental movement. You can see a dynamic from mainstream environmentalism in the 1970s to Earth First, which emerged in the U.S. in 1980. And Dave Foreman, one of the co-founders of Earth First, by the way, worked first as a mainstream lobbyist for the environment. And so he had an insider's view of how corrupt the political process was, and he realized that we could never protect the environment from a lobbying standpoint by trying to play the game of the politicians and the corporate money changers. And so he realized that we need to start a direct action movement that was called Earth First, and at least initially in its history, used economic sabotage and tactics of property destruction. But in England in the early 1990s, it was realized that even Earth First was too conservative, and we needed more powerful weapons of destruction, such as arson. And so the Earth Liberation Front emerged as a faction out of Earth First, and that thereafter spread throughout Europe and into the United States. So you see there's kind of a progression of radicalism, where it's realized that each existing form is inadequate, has its limitations, and something more radical is needed. And so we can only imagine that at some point the tactics of, say, the Animal Liberation Front might prove far too conservative, far too limited, and that maybe what we really need is armed struggle to protect the interests of animals, and maybe someday the struggle will evolve to that level, as it has with so many human rights struggles, human justice struggles have been fought from the barrel of a gun. It may happen with animal liberation, too. So who can predict the future, but it seems to be one of increasing radicalism.
Yeah, many people seem to express reluctance to even think about that idea or talk about it, but in the book Igniting Revolution, I mean, a lot of people talk about, like, the abolition of slavery, for example, and many other different movements which are championed now, which did involve armed struggle and all kinds of things which would be considered radical by those who are benefiting from the continuation of such things, you know?
Yeah.
So, I'm glad to see, it's a very kind of comprehensive discussion going on in this book, and I'm really glad you're bringing it up.
Yeah, I mean, all tactics are around the table. All tactics have to be discussed. When Malcolm X said, by any means necessary, he meant using violence strictly as a means of self-defense. When radical or revolutionary environmentalists are using the term by any means necessary, they're also speaking now of using it not just in self-defense of themselves, but in self-defense of the earth, right? So it's interesting that all of the justifications that Bush uses to invade Iraq, or that people use to defend violence in general, a lot of them come down to self-defense. If we're talking about the defense of animals, what I call extensional self-defense, because they can't defend themselves, we need to defend their interests for them, their lives for them. And who's going to defend the earth? Well, we're defending the earth. This is, in effect, a kind of self-defense of the earth. Then violence makes, whether or not it's tactically wise, it's justified according to the same kind of arguments used to justify violence in the human world. Use the same kind of arguments used by Bush. People shouldn't be shocked when some people talk about using violence to defend animals or to defend the earth. This is a violent world. This is a violent society. Our corporate and political leaders use and talk about violence all the time. So when it's done in these movements, really it's just using the same kind of arguments that they use in extended ways.